All right. I have to make y'all suffer through some terrible jokes just because it's part of it. What do you call the little helpers in the North Pole with Santa? They felt bad about themselves. Why did they feel bad? Why did they feel bad about themselves? They had low elf esteem. Yeah, I know. It's bad. What do you call a deer with no eyes? No idea. What do you call a deer with one very effective eye in the middle of its head? Good idea. Yeah, good idea. A turtle got mugged by two slugs. Cops came up, said, "Mr. Turtle, heard you got mugged by two slugs." Turtle said, "Yeah." Cop said, "Can you tell me what happened? Can you give me any details?" The turtle said, "No, it all happened so fast." Now, this one's pretty tough. Some audiences have trouble getting this one. It goes by fast. You got to catch it, all right? Two silkworms got in a race. They ended up in a tie. All right. That's all you get. Tommy loved Mr. Johnson. Mr. Johnson was Tommy's sixth grade science teacher, and for the first time in Tommy's life, he enjoyed going to a class. Mr. Johnson made learning science so much fun. Now, the kids loved Mr. Johnson. Mr. Johnson was about 28 years old, had a master's degree in biology. He drove a red convertible sports car, had a beautiful fiance, and could answer any question that there was about science right off the top of his head. And Tommy thought that was something else. Now, Tommy, every now and then in class, would pick up something that sounded different than what he had learned at home. Like when they went over the discussion of dinosaurs, he heard Mr. Johnson talk about millions of years and how humans and dinosaurs were separated by 65 million years, some stuff like that. But it never really dawned on Tommy what was going on until today. Today, Mr. Johnson said, "Class, it's an exciting day. We're going to learn where the universe came from. Can anyone tell me how the universe got here?" Eugene Lipton's hand shot up. Eugene Lipton read his science book for fun. He made a 100 on every single science test that was ever given, unless there were bonus questions. And then he made a 105. He always answered every question first. And Mr. Johnson, in the normal style, said, "Eugene, thank you. Yes, can you tell us?" And Eugene said, "13.7 billion years ago, a tiny ball of matter called a singularity exploded in what is commonly referred to in scientific parlance as the Big Bang." And he went into the scientific explanation as to how the universe got here. Well, the class was kind of blown away. Mr. Johnson said, "That's great, Eugene. Thank you. Very good. Can anybody explain to me how life got here?" Katie raised her hand. She said, "Yes. 4.7 billion years ago, there was a group of chemicals on the surface of the earth that lightning somehow struck those and caused the first amino acids to form, and those amino acids got together and formed the first single-celled life." And she gave the textbook answer. Now, Tommy had a problem, because Tommy knew that's not what he had been taught. And you know what? Out of the 30 kids in that class, 27 of them knew that's not what they had been taught either. But Tommy didn't know what to do. I mean, yeah, Tommy's dad was smart. He knew how to fix a wash machine or dryer. But he couldn't tell you that the earth was 93 million miles from the sun. He couldn't tell you that the moon was 240,000 miles from the earth. He couldn't tell you the speed of light. He couldn't tell you the acceleration rate of gravity. He couldn't tell you that stuff. Well, Stephen raised his hand in the back. And Mr. Johnson said, "Yes, Stephen, you got something to say?" And Stephen, in a shaky but brave voice, said, "That's not right." He said, "My dad says that the universe was created by God." Now, 30 little heads whipped around to look at Mr. Johnson and see what he's going to do with that, because that's what their dads had said too. And they were all surprised when Mr. Johnson threw a grin across his face and said, "Stephen, I was hoping that someone would bring that up. Where'd your dad get that idea?" And Stephen said, "Well, the book of Genesis." Mr. Johnson said, "Is that in the Bible?" Stephen said, "Yeah." Mr. Johnson said, "Great, thank you, Stephen." And he went over and he opened his top drawer and he pulled out a leather-bound black book. And he said, "Your dad's Bible look anything like this?" Stephen said, "Yeah, it does." He opened it to the book of Genesis And he started reading. And it said, doeth and maketh and hath and hath. And Mr. Johnson said, now, class, let me ask you a real quick question. Does this book sound old? For whatever else it sounded, it did sound old. He said, let me tell you, class, this book is great when it comes to answering some questions. In fact, over in some of the other books, there's a guy by the name of Jesus, and he says, do unto others as you want them to do to you. And that's great advice. But he said, this book is old. It's outdated. Science has disproven the ideas in this book. In fact, he said, you know, there were lots of people in the past that used to believe that the earth was flat. We now know the earth's not flat. In fact, you can look at the earth from a picture from space and see that it's a sphere, that it's a globe, and you can look at this globe up here and see a good representation of it. You know the people who wrote this book thought the earth was flat. And he flipped over to one of the passages in Psalms that talked about the four corners of the earth. And he said, does the earth have corners? He said, class, this is an old book. It's written by people that during their time, they were very intelligent, but science has marched on past these people, and this book is outdated, and you can't use it for scientific information any longer. And he put that book back in his drawer, and he went right on teaching. Boy, I wish I could tell you that doesn't happen. I wish I could tell you I was just making that story up. In one sense, I am. In one sense, yeah, nobody named Tommy, nobody named Mr. Johnson. In another sense, that story could be multiplied by the thousands across this country every single school year. Let me tell you how I know that. I was up in Maryland, right outside Washington, D.C. They said, you know what? At our school, you can't read the Bible. I said, what do you mean you can't read the Bible? They said, you can't read it. The junior at the time who was talking to me, he was about, oh, you're looking at 16, 17 years old. He said, I was in my study hall off period. I was sitting down reading the Bible. The assistant principal came up to me and said, put that book up. I don't want to see that out again in this school. Put it in your bag. Don't get it out. His eighth grade brother sitting across from me said, oh, yeah, if you go into the library in this school and you start looking on the web for Christianity, Bible, all those sites are blocked just like a pornographic site. Now, you can look up Islam. I said, can you look up Islam? Can you look up other? He said, yeah, you just can't look up Christianity. You just can't look up the Bible. I was outside of Nashville, Tennessee. You look at Nashville, Tennessee, Williamson County. You're talking about the buckle of the Bible Belt right there. I mean, those states are bleeding red. Right outside of Nashville, Williamson County, a grandmother said, yeah, my third grade son was in the Williamson County school system. They have a period they call drop everything and read. Then you're supposed to just bring a book from home and you're supposed to just get to read it, whatever book you want to. Said my third grade grandson brought the Bible. The teacher said, you can't bring that Bible here. You can't read it. They said, let's drop everything and read. They said, no, you can bring any other book you want, but not the Bible. If you think that atheistic evolution is not the official teaching of our public school system, think again. Now, let me qualify that by saying this. There are places still in our country that do not teach it. When I was growing up, I went to Santa Fe High School. If you're from there, you call it Santa Fe. If you're not, you call it Santa Fe. And that's the difference between how you know if somebody's from there or not. Well, I went to Santa Fe. My principal was a member of the church. My vice principal was a member of the church. My English teacher was a member of the church. The girls' basketball coach was a member of the church who started dating the boys' basketball coach who converted him, and he became a member of the church. The geography teacher was married to a member of the church, and he later was converted. And if you were to say, the valedictorian was a member of the church, the salutatorian was a member of the church, and it was one of the most religious, graduations that anybody's ever seen. And if you wanted to talk about God at Santa Fe Elementary School and High School when I was going to Santa Fe, you could do it all day long. And everybody would pat you on the back and say, good job. What I mean by that is there are still some systems where people are in charge in the principal position or a superintendent position where the truth can still be taught. But officially, our country is atheistic when it teaches atheistic evolution. Now, let me show you some of the demonstration of that fact. This is from a man by the name of Daniel Dennett. In Darwin's Dangerous Idea, he said, if you teach a kid creation, that the Bible's true and that Adam was created by God and Eve from his, you teach him that, when he gets to our school systems, then those of us who have the freedom of speech will feel free to describe your teaching as the spreading of falsehoods, and will attempt to demonstrate this to your children at our earliest opportunity. Now, their earliest opportunity is when they step over the threshold to the school system. We have seen it go as young as preschool, kindergarten, first grade, second grade, third grade. If you pick up the books, you will see it all through the books. And we have had experiences with people who have come up to us and said, my kid went to preschool, and here's what they started teaching my kid in preschool. Now, what is this evidence that's supposed to show that evolution is a fact and that creation is unscientific, and that if any person with a logical, rational mind would assess this, they would all be evolutionists? What is this overwhelming, powerful evidence that they're going to teach all those who are teaching their kids falsehoods of creation? What are they using to show that evolution is just so true? Well, let's look. Because what I'm prepared to say is, yes, somebody's teaching falsehoods. Somebody is. But I think you're going to see that the people who are teaching falsehoods are not the ones that Daniel Dennett claims to be. If you were to go to your standard evolutionary textbook-based science book, evolutionary-based science book, you would hear the story of the English peppered moth. This is hailed as evolution in action. The English peppered moth story goes something like this. Before the Industrial Revolution, 95% of the English peppered moths were the light color. 5% were the dark color. I don't know if you can get into the mind of a bird, but if you could, and you were a bird, which one of these two would you eat? Oh, obviously, you would eat the black one, because you could see the black one. And you can't see the light-colored one because it's camouflaged by the lichens on the tree trunks. And so the reason that 95% of the moths were light-colored and 5% were dark-colored, according to the evolutionary system here, is because natural selection was working on the moth population and the dark ones were getting eaten. And that's why 5% of them were dark and 95% were light-colored. Easy to understand. And then the Industrial Revolution hit. Killed all the lichens on the trees. Now, if you're a bird, which one of these two are you going to eat? Oh, yeah, I mean, you're going to eat the light one because you can see it. So the population changes from 95% dark to from 95% light to 95% dark, and from 5% dark to 5% light. Now, this was hailed as evolution in action and has been used in virtually every textbook on evolution for the last, you're looking at 50, 60 years. And let's analyze it real quick, just for a second. Isn't it amazing to you how those moths landed perfectly on that tree trunk so that they fit right in the frame of a picture? You know, that's something, isn't it? And somehow you got a dark one that lands right above a light one. Do you think they really land like that in nature? Oh, guess what? Number one, before the Industrial Revolution, you had the genetic information for two kinds of moth, two flavors of moth, we'll say, light-colored and dark-colored. After the Industrial Revolution, you had the genetic information for what? Two kinds of moth, what? Light-colored and dark-colored. Any evolution going on in here? A moth changing into any other kind of animal? You got a moth changing into a lizard, like a loth or a mizzard? No, that's not what you got. You got a moth changing into a bird, or even an English pepper moth changing into some other kind of freak moth type. Nothing even like that. You know, what if I said I had a dog that had puppies, and this dog had 100 puppies? Now, this would be freak. It'd be hypothetical, of course, but work with me here. And I said, I got a dog that had 100 puppies here, and 95 of them are dark-colored, and 5 of them are light-colored. They were walking across a pond, and in a tragic puppy accident, the pond was frozen, but one place was too thin, and 94 of the dark-colored puppies fell into the pond. Now I've got 5 light-colored puppies and 1 dark-colored puppy left. Evolution in action. Is that evolution? Did the genetic information change at all? No, that's nothing. That is absolutely, positively nothing. But here's the second most problematic aspect of this. English peppered moths don't land on tree trunks. No, those pictures that look so good right there, they're made up. They caught the English peppered moss and they pinned them on there, or they glued them on there, or they artificially placed them on there. English pepper moss lands on the bottom of leaves, bottom side of leaves. They fly mostly at night, and most of the leaves that they land on are green, so it doesn't matter if they're dark colored or light colored. If a bird could see them on the underside of a leaf, the bird would probably eat either one of them because the leaf is green and they don't really fit in the green color. Now, you would hope that the evolutionists who are claiming that the creationists are spreading falsehoods would not know this to be the case. I mean, what you would hope is, okay, guys, maybe you just didn't know that the English peppered moss were fake, that the pictures were fraudulent, that you just made them up. Well, but no, not really. They did know this. In fact, look, Bob Ritter, a Canadian textbook writer who knew that the moth pictures were fake but used them anyway, he said, well, I mean, you got to look at the audience. How convoluted do you want to make it for a first-time learner? He said, yeah, I mean, this might be false, but it makes the point so well that even a fifth grader can understand it. So instead of convoluting it, let's just keep using it. You know, I'll tell you how convoluted I'd like to make it. You tell people the truth. Wouldn't that be nice? Watch what he says. Well, the advantage of this example of natural selection is that it's extremely visual. Now, hold on just a second. If this is not true, is it an example of natural selection? If it's not true, see if this would fly. What if I said, guys, I'll tell you what, I've got a herd of white cows. Oh, boy, they're pretty white cows. But I've got a new theory that I think you're going to love. And here's my theory. When white cows eat green grass, they grow purple spots. And you said, Kyle, that's crazy. And I said, no, hold on. I've got proof. I've got evidence for this. In fact, anybody who tells you different is spreading a falsehood because I can prove this. And so I bring my 10 white cows out, and I put them outside on your beautifully sodded yard out there, and I let them eat your grass. And I say, all right, I'll tell you what, come back after break, 3 o'clock, you come back after break, you're going to see they all got purple spots. Sure enough, you come back after break, guess what? Purple spots all over them. You say, wow, Kyle, that's amazing. In fact, one of you who is not doesn't have a phobia of bovines, you go up to the cow, you pet the cow, you say, wow, this is a beautiful cow. Yeah, sure enough, they do all have purple spots. You start getting an itch on your forehead, so you itch your forehead, and you look at your buddy, and your buddy starts laughing at you. And you say, what's the problem? And your buddy says, you got purple paint all over your forehead. You look at your hand, there's purple paint all over the hand that you just scratched your forehead with. You go to the cow, you start wiping the cow off with a paper towel, and purple paint's all over the cow. You say, Kyle, they don't grow purple spots. You painted these on there. I say, I know. But the advantage of this example is that it's extremely visual. How far am I going to get with a theory like that? You know, not very far. Watch what he says. We want to get across the idea of selective adaptation. Later on, they can look at it more critically. Hey, we know it's false, but you know what? We're trying to make a point here. And so, to make our point, we're just going to keep using it. Later, they can find out that it's wrong. When is later on? Do you know that if you go to high school, you go through high school, you're not going to see any of the books that correct this? You won't see a single book that says, oh, you know, guess what? Those English peppered moth pictures, they were fake. You need to start looking at that more critically. What, in college, you think so? Did you ever see one? Do you know there's a man with a PhD in one of the sciences who was irate that the English peppered moth continued to be used because he went through a terminal degree in science. And never once was he told that the English peppered moth pictures were fake and that the system did not teach evolution in action. You know when later on is? You're looking at it. Seminar like this. And guess what? I can maybe get 20, 30, 40 high school kids to something like this. When I'm really blessed to have an opportunity, I can sometimes speak to 300, 400, 600, 700 kids all at once. I'm going to a Challenge Youth Conference in Gatlinburg, Tennessee in February. I can speak to 5,000 at once. But guess what? I might get to speak to 10,000 kids a year. You know how many of them are reading textbooks that have this in it? 10 million. And later on just doesn't come for many of those kids. Here's what was ironic. I was teaching this material, talking to a girl. She was in ninth grade, I think. She was up on the front row. This is up in Michigan, I think it was. They think I talk funny in Michigan. Down here I fit in pretty well, but up there, not so much. She said, she wrote me, I think it was 2 weeks later, it might have been a week. She said, guess what they taught us today in biology class? She said, I almost busted out laughing. They taught us today that English peppered moths prove evolution to be true, and I had listened to your lecture, seminar on that, and it was funny to me that they were trying to teach that. You know, that's exciting, isn't it? But what if I hadn't been in, Michigan 2 weeks before? And she sat in that class and they taught her about the English peppered moth scenario and she never got to look at it more critically later on. Huh? Well, you see what we're up against here. Somebody is spreading falsehoods. It's not us. It's not the people who are teaching the biblical account of creation, because the biblical account of creation matches scientific evidence perfectly. Listen to me close. There is not a single verified, validated fact out there that does not harmonize with the creation account found in the book of Genesis. There's not one. Now, there are all kinds of scientific facts that do not harmonize with the atheistic position on atheistic evolution. And here's the evidence that's supposed to be used to show that we're spreading falsehoods. Doesn't make a lot of sense, does it? Keep going with me. This guy's name is Ernst Haeckel. Haeckel, in 1860, read Charles Darwin's book. Now, this is just an aside. You don't need this for anything other than your information. Lots of times, as a creationist, someone will come to you or come to us and say, well, you're not qualified to speak on biology. You're not qualified to speak on physics. You don't have a PhD in biology or in physics. You can't speak on anything unless you've got at least a graduate degree in that. Do you understand that Charles Darwin had no earned degrees other than a degree in theology? That was it. So if you're going to say that a person has to have a terminal degree or even a graduate degree or even a regular college degree in something, Charles Darwin didn't have a degree in anything but theology. Now, Darwin in 1859 wrote his book On the Origin of Species by Natural Selection, or The Preservation of Favored Races. And in 1860, it was translated into German. Ernst Haeckel read it and said, wow, that's amazing. That is so right. In fact, it's so right, I'm going to find evidence that proves it. And so he did, he said. Came up with the law of embryology. Boy, it sounded good too to his University of Jena students. He said, ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. Sounds good, doesn't it? I'll repeat it for you. Ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. And his students said, wow. That is so smart, it's got to be right. Now, let me translate that for you. It's real easy to understand. The ontogeny of an organism is its embryological development. Recap or recapitulates means goes through again. If you recap a ball game, you just go through the ball game and hit the highlight. Phylogeny is the supposed evolutionary history of an organism. So if humans supposedly evolved from something like chimpanzees, and that chimpanzee supposedly evolved from something like a lemur, and that lemur supposedly evolved from something like a rat, and that rat supposedly evolved from something like a lizard, then you should be able to look at an organism's embryological development, its ontogeny, and you should see it going through every one of those stages. You should see a fish stage, a lizard stage, a lemur stage, a mouse stage. You should see all those. And Haeckel said, I've got evidence that those are there. They are. And so he presented to the world his pictures of embryos. And he said, look how similar they are. He said, listen, right there on the top, if you'll look closely, you will see that they all have gill slits. All of them. And he said, look how similar all these are. And they come down here. He said, ontogeny does recapitulate phylogeny. And some of his fellow professors said, wow, that is interesting. I'll hold up. Haeckel, where'd you get those pictures? Oh, huh. Good question. I drew them. From what? I mean, were you looking at an embryo? Well, no. Some of them I drew from memory. Even then, some of them look really, really, really similar. Oh, yeah, well, sometimes I draw one embryo three times and label it three different things. Like I draw a dog embryo three times and I'd label it a dog, a pig, and a human embryo. They said, so you made this up? Yeah, I did. A lot of it. But we do that a lot in science to make a point. Well, no. No, we're not supposed to. In fact, when you look at his embryos compared to the real pictures of the embryos, they don't really look similar in a lot of respects. And many of his own peers said, no, Haeckel, that's wrong. You're coming up with something that does not make sense. And guess what? In the late 1800s, we knew this was false. When I say we, that's the editorial we. I wasn't around in the late 1800s, but the people who were around in the 1800s, knew 1880s, knew this was false. It's 2012 right now. From 1880 to 2012, we've known this was false for about 140 years. So surely this wouldn't get in textbooks, would it? To teach evolution, ever. We've known it's false for 140 years, and yet, listen to me, this has been in the majority of textbooks that have been used in public school systems. I was talking to the Alabama Christian Academy 10th graders, and I was explaining this to them. The biology teacher that was there perked up when I showed this book. He said, oh yeah, I went to the University of Western Florida, and that's the book I used. And it taught Haeckel's embryos as evidence for evolution. Now, natural history, the year 2000, a man by the name of Stephen Jay Gould wrote an article titled Atrocious. Haeckel's embryos did not help Darwin. Now here's what he says. Haeckel remains most famous today as the chief architect and propagandist for a famous argument, oh now listen close, that science disproved long ago, but that popular culture has never fully abandoned. If only because the standard description sounds so wonderfully arcane and mellifluous. Ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, otherwise known as the theory of recapitulation, or roughly the claim that an organism retraces its evolutionary history. Now watch what he says. We should, therefore, not be surprised that Haeckel's drawings entered 19th century textbooks. Now stop right there. Stop reading and listen to me. He said, you know what? Guess what? It shouldn't surprise us that some wrong information gets into textbooks. But now watch what he says. But we do, I think, have the right to be both astonished and ashamed by a century of mindless recycling that's led to the persistence of these drawings in a large number, if not the majority, of modern textbooks. He said, you know, guess what? For the last 100 years, the textbooks have been recycling this stuff, and we've known it's been false. Oh, guess what? You know what? I travel around the country, and I tell young people that Haeckel's embryos are no longer valid evidence, and they never were, for evolution. And I have young people contact me and say, guess what we learned next week, the week after that, 2 weeks ago? Guess what we just got through studying about Haeckel's embryos? Any science class that I show up to that's got a biology book, I will flip it open, and within a matter of 3 minutes, I can find either Haeckel's embryos or a distorted version of it that talks about similarities in embryos but doesn't mention Haeckel's name anymore. Now, how is that? For 100 years, is somebody spreading falsehood? Yeah, somebody is. These are some of the books. 1999, I thought you guys would be interested in this. 1999, Texas Board of Education adopted this biology textbook as its book in biology. I don't know if you've ever seen that particular book, but guess what? Haeckel's embryos, right in it. Biology 101, the Unity and Diversity of Life, Central Michigan University. Those are just some of the books. Now, you ever seen this picture? Oh, yeah, man, that's horse evolution right there. Flat out. You got Hyracotherium right here, also known as Eohippus, evolving up into Mesohippus and Myohippus and Merychippus and Pliohippus and modern Equus. Boy, that's amazing, isn't it? It goes from the three little toes, and you can see them getting gradually smaller and smaller and smaller. Boom, to the one toe. I was at the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. Boy, you talk about something else. Millions and millions of dollars poured into the Smithsonian. Where'd they get money to put all that stuff up? Oh yeah, you paid your taxes. And they took that tax money and thought, here, we're going to put this stuff up. I walked into what I call the Shrine of Horse Evolution. I bet it cost them $1 million to build. Had this in detailed form, showed the bones, showed the pictures, showed majestic landscapes of these early precursors to horse jumping all over the place. I walked out on the balcony and watched as kids poured in. I asked one of the officials at the Smithsonian, how many kids come into this museum every day? It's free, guess what? It's free. You don't have to pay a dime to go to the Smithsonian Museum of Natural History. You know why? Because you already paid for it. All you that pay taxes already paid for it. Nobody pays a dime. You just walk right in. There's a big old huge mammoth elephant at the very opening, welcomes you in there. 10,000 kids a day. 10,000 a day. I don't know how many of them walk into Shrine to Horse Evolution, but there it is, sure enough. Oh, you know what? Guess what? Horse Evolution, we've known this has been false since the 50s. The family tree of the horse is beautiful and continuous only in textbooks. The construction of the horse is a very artificial one. It cannot be a continuous transformation series. Now listen to me. What does this show it as? A continuous transformation series. From one to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next. I said, no, that didn't happen in nature. The only place that ever happened was in a textbook. And guess how many times it happened in a textbook? Millions and millions and millions. And not only did it happen in a textbook, it happened in the Smithsonian Museum of Natural History, and it's happening 10,000 times a day. Now, watch what they say. Our man Stephen Jay Gould, is not your friend. Stephen Jay Gould is very adamantly opposed to the idea of creation. This is George Gaylor Simpson. I'm going to get to Gould's next. Simpson says, the uniform continuous transformation of Hierocotherium into Equus, so dear to the hearts of generations of textbook writers, never happened in nature. Didn't happen. We made it up. All those pictures, we just drew them. We just made them up. Now watch what Gould says. Once ensconced in textbooks. Okay, now do not miss this word. Do not miss it. If you're dozing off, wake up and watch this word. Misinformation becomes cocooned. What did Dennett say he was going to say about anybody who taught their kids creation? They were spreading what? Falsehoods. What is Stephen Jay Gould recognizing is being used to teach evolution right here? Falsehoods. He says it becomes effectively cocooned and permanent because, as we stated, textbooks copy from previous texts. I've written two essays on this lamentable practice, one on the amusingly perennial description of Eohippus, or Don Horse, as the size of a fox terrier, even though most authors, including yours truly, have no idea the dimensions or appearance of the breed. We don't know when it showed up. We don't know how big it was. But we've been using it for years to teach evolution. And watch what he says. The amusingly perennial. You know what perennial means? It just keeps coming back every year, year after year, year after year. But here's the word that irks me so bad on this particular quote, amusingly. Isn't it funny? Doesn't it just make you chuckle? That year after year after year, our kids are being told that they evolved from primordial slime with evidence that horses evolved, and we use Eohippus or Hierocotherium to prove that. And guess what? We've known. We've known for years that that's not true, but it just keeps popping up. Is that funny to you? Is that humorous? Is that amusing to you? Doesn't that just make you laugh and you just think, oh, that millions of dollars of our tax dollars and all kinds of time has been spent using this information to teach evolution. And we've known it's not true and it just keeps popping up. That hacks me off. Makes me mad. To me, there's not one thing that's amusing about that. To me, this is a classic example of what is used to prove the truth of evolution. And you know I'm putting the truth in quotation marks. Because this is not how science ought to work. In fact, it's not how true science does work. There's you. The Ardipithecus ramidus cadaba. Basal root ancestor. That guy's supposed to be your basal root ancestor 6 million years ago. That creature evolved from something like a chimpanzee and started walking upright, as far as you know. Looking at that picture anyway. Although, you know, if you get into the article, they tell us that we haven't collected enough bones to reconstruct what it really looked like. Although there are pictures throughout the whole article of it. Oh, well, how many bones have you collected? I mean, surely you've collected 50% of the creature, or 60% or 70%, 30% maybe? Oh, no, really we've collected, this looks maybe like quite a few bones. Actually, it's only 11 bones. Those toe bones that you see right there on the right side, it's like a picture of the front and the back. It's not like there are more than 11 bones here. We've collected 11 bones from at least 5 individuals. Oh, that means averaging 2 bones per creature. And then we're told that we know this is our basal root ancestor because what? Well, because it walked upright. And how do you know it walked upright? Well, because of this toe bone right here. Well, I want you to look at that close. This is in Time magazine. It was on the front cover. This was groundbreaking, earth-shattering news. Front cover had a big old picture of Ardipithecus ramidus cadaba staring right at you like he knew what your birthday was. How did you know he walked upright? Well, this toe bone right here. Look at it. What toe bone's tough looking, isn't it? You know how many bones you got in your feet? 26. Do you know what you could know from a toe bone about your walking upright? What's that say about your hip? Your hip's kind of important for walking upright, isn't it? Well, that says nothing. What's it say about your knee bone? Kind of important for walking upright? Nothing. You couldn't tell if a creature walked upright from a toe bone if you wanted to. Oh, but hold on, that's not the biggest issue here. Here's the biggest issue. You remember they said 11 specimens, two average from each individual, from a cluster of sites. What's a cluster of sites to you? Oh, you find one over here in the corner of the building, go 5 or 10 yards or 100 yards and find another. Oh, no, no, no. That's not a cluster of sites. Listen to me. This toe bone right here? Oh, well, not only was the toe bone separated in time by several hundred thousand years, but it was found 10 miles away from the rest of them. We got in our car going 60 miles an hour for 10 minutes, stopped, got out, found a bone that was also a toe bone. We compared it to the other bones that we had, and our flawed dating methods that we used said it was several hundred thousand years separate from these other bones. And somehow we connected it to that same animal, even though we say it was several hundred thousand years separate from it, and said this proves that this creature walked upright, and that's how you ought to know that you evolved from a primordial blob of slime. Now that's good thinking, isn't it? I mean, that's logical, scientific, very robust reasoning, isn't it? You know, I'm not trying to make light of people who believe this. In fact, there are lots of people who believe this information that are smarter than I'll ever hope to be. But the information is wrong. It's not correct, and you have to do something other than think correctly to arrive at the conclusion that evolution is true. Let me show you what else I mean by that. Here's Piltdown Man. Piltdown Man in 1912. They found the skull cap of what looked like a human, but it looked like it had a jawbone of an orangutan. And they thought, you know what, yeah, this is a half and half critter. Looked like he was almost human, but he had a jawbone of orangutan. His teeth were shorter than orangutan. Yeah, this is a half and half critter. You remember the Scopes monkey trial in Tennessee? Dayton, Tennessee there? In 1925, John T. Scopes was sued by the state of Tennessee for teaching evolution. Several of the most high-powered evolutionists of the day put sworn affidavits as to how they know that humans evolved from primates. Guess what some of their factual information was? Piltdown Man, he's in there. This is how we know humans evolved from primates. Piltdown Man. For 40 years, Piltdown Man was recognized and lauded as an example of evidence that proves humans evolved from primates for 40 years. You know how long 40 years is? That's 5 years longer than I've been alive. That's an entire generation. An entire generation! Oh, and then in 1952, somebody decided they were going to take a closer look at Piltdown Man, and so they zoomed in their microscopes and they said, oh, hold on just a second, it looked like somebody took something like tea and dyed this skull to make it look old, and they took a file and filed down the teeth out of an orangutan, and they took the jaw of an orangutan and they hooked it to the skull cap of a human. This is fake. Oh, guess what? Yeah, it is. Fake. Now, I'm not talking about you just missed it. I'm talking about it was intentionally fraudulent. And yet for 40 years it was used as evidence to prove that humans evolved from primates. And it was in sworn affidavits from the world's highest thinking evolutionist as evidence that humans evolved from primates. And it was false as false could be. How many of these examples do you got to show? Ardipithecus rhombus, Kadaba, Piltdown Man, I could show you. You know, the truth is, this is just, I could show you tons more. Nebraska Man, they found a tooth. They said, this tooth proves that humans evolved from primates. Oh, they found that it was from an extinct pig. They said, oh, yeah, right here, Orca Man, found a bone, skull cap, from a six-month-old donkey, most likely. They found a collarbone, they thought. Where's the collarbone? Flipper Man, collarbone, found in the Libyan desert. Guess what they said? Oh, yeah, this proves that humans evolved 5 million years ago. Oh, well, actually, that's a rib bone from a dolphin. How many times you got to do that? Let me show you where this ends. Let me show you where it goes. Now, listen to me. Before you hear this guy, Colin Patterson was the senior paleontologist at the British Museum of Natural History in 1978 and 79. That means he knows more about evolution and fossils than anybody else in the world, with the possible exception of the senior paleontologist of the American Museum of Natural History in New York. This guy is the pinnacle of evolutionary knowledge in 1978-79. He starts traveling around the world giving lectures on how to classify organisms. Because there was one group called the Cladists that said you should classify them based on their structure. Another group said, no, you should classify them based on their evolutionary history. And so he was trying to determine, well, how do you know their evolutionary history? Which group should we use their thinking to classify all of these animals? Now, what he didn't know was that there was a creationist in one of his audiences who recorded word for word on a cassette tape. You've heard of those. Yeah, some of you have actually even seen some of them. On a cassette tape, recorded it. And here is word for word what Colin Patterson said. Now, he has subsequently came out and said, no, you misunderstood what I was saying. But there's no misunderstanding what Colin Patterson is saying in this particular speech. In fact, if I understand it correctly, he delivered this speech all over the country. And here's what he said. I think always before in my life, when I've got up to speak on a subject, I've been confident of one thing, that I know more about it than anybody in the room, because I've worked on it. Well, this time it isn't true. I'm speaking on two subjects, evolutionism and creationism, and I believe it's true to say that I know nothing whatever about either of them. One of the reasons I started taking this anti-evolutionary view, or let's call it a non-evolutionary view, was that last year I had a sudden realization. For over 20 years I thought I was working on evolution in some way. One morning I woke up and something happened in the night. And it struck me that I'd been working on this stuff for more than 20 years and there wasn't a thing I knew about it. Now listen to it. It's quite a shock to learn that one can be misled for so long. Either there was something wrong with me or there was something wrong with evolutionary theory. Love this part. Naturally, I know there's nothing wrong with me. So, for the last few weeks, I've tried putting a simple question to various people in groups. Question, can you tell me anything about that you know about evolution? Any one thing that's true? He was the pinnacle of evolutionary knowledge. Should have been. Senior paleontologist at the British Museum of Natural History said, I've been working on this stuff for 20 years, and guess what? It dawned on me the other night when I woke up that I didn't know a single thing about it. You know why you didn't know a single thing about it? Because the textbooks are filled with stuff that are misleading our youth. And he admits it and said that I was misled. Now I'll tell you what. Seems like to me it's high time that Christians decided that we are not going to allow people to mislead young people or not so young people anymore. We're going to stand up and we're going to defend the truth that God created everybody and that they are special because they're made in the image of God and they did not evolve from primordial slime, and the scientific evidence does not show that. Do you know how many times I have heard a person say, you know what, Kyle, I would teach that, but you know, I'll probably get fired from my job. I would teach that, but you know, the school system tells us we got to teach evolution. Now, no offense to you personally, but listen to me. If the Apostle Paul said, I would teach about Jesus, but the Jewish leaders say, I just can't, or I'm going to get in trouble. Can you imagine him saying, okay, you know, to keep my job as a fisherman in the Sea of Galilee, I'm going to make sure I teach that fish evolved from primordial slime? No. And I'll tell you what else I've seen. I have seen people that are teaching falsehoods, the falsehood of atheistic evolution, and they will say, I'm going to teach it whether you fire me or not. And if someone tries to fire them for teaching it, they will take it to the highest court in the land, and they'll sue anybody they have to keep their job. And yet I've seen New Testament Christians who had the truth and who let scores or hundreds or thousands of people go through their teaching systems, never once telling them they were created by God, special because they're humans in the image of God, and that what they're being taught from the evolutionary community is false. Now, what's it going to take for us to stand up? Is it going to have to come to the idea that you can't do it anymore? That you will be jailed for it? Is that what it's going to take? Because guess what? Brooks High School doesn't have a prayer before their ball games now. And they've had a prayer before their ball games for the last 40 years. And they don't pray now. Why? It's because so many of us have said, well, maybe this will correct itself. Maybe somehow this will change without me having to do anything. No, it's not going to change without you doing something. Guess what? This is it. You're looking at the people right here that care enough to spend a Saturday to listen to this stuff, that have the power to do something. And I don't know how much power you got. Do you have the power to change a single person's mind? Sometimes that's all it takes. Had a mother call us at Apologetics Express. She said, Kyle, just got through reading your Truth Be Told book. She said, I want to give one of these out to every one of my son's fellow students in his first grade class. I said, you know, that's a 6th through 8th grade book, middle school. She said, I know, but it's got the information they need. I want them to have it. She said, how many? We said, how many you need? She said, oh, I need about 30. She said, how much can I get them for? I think we give them to her for $3 a piece. She went to the principal. He said, well, you know, officially we can't hand out a book like that, but I'll tell you what you need to do. Give it to your son's fellow students as a Christmas present. All right? She did. Took those 30, gave them to the other 30 kids as a Christmas present that December. First graders. She said the next year in second grade, they had a teacher that was very pro-evolution, teaching this junk. She said one of the kids, not affiliated with the church at all, the only association that her son had with this kid was that this kid was in his class in first grade and got a Truth Be Told book. This kid said to the teacher, well, what you're teaching us is not right. And the teacher said, no, yes, it is. It's in the books. And the kid said, no, I've got a book that says it's not right. And the teacher said, well, what that book says is wrong. And the second grader said to his teacher, well, what that book says makes a whole lot better sense than what you're telling us. You know, doesn't it, though? Make a lot better sense than what they're hearing. And it's time that we find a way to do something about empowering young people and anybody with the information they need so they can stand up and say, that's not right, because what this says makes a lot better sense than what you're telling. Sure, appreciate it. All right, I think we'll take about a 10-minute break, and we'll be back in here in 10 minutes. So, is it 3 right now, though? Hold on. Wait just a second. Okay, cookies. What did he say? There were 37 different kinds of cookies back there? Yes. So, 4-year-olds go last. That's what I heard.